Greetings, friends out there. We're gathered together here today in a very special kind of an AA meeting, one that was dreamed up by my friends at the headquarters, and the thought was that we would discuss the AA traditions. I like this idea because, as you know, it's been impossible for Lois and me to travel extensively in AA and to contact you as we used to. It strikes us that films of this sort may be the very best bet. Of course, one thing I like about this AA meeting in particular is that I'm assigned to do all of the talking. I still have some vestiges of ego. Speaking of ego, this had a great deal to do with the formation of AA's tradition in the first place. As every AA knows, we shall always be threatened by menacing forces within, and certainly in the world of great peril in which we live today, by menacing forces without. So, a very prime problem, the prime problem of AA, is first how to survive, and then to grow and prosper in numbers and in spiritual substance over the years to come. As practically every hearer knows, the traditions are the application of AA's 12 steps, the spirit of those steps, to the practical problems of living and working together as a harmonious society, of rightly relating ourselves to those forces which have so often torn societies apart, the problems of money, problems of power, of prestige, of management of properties, and so on. As I look over the list of traditions, I am frankly flabbergasted at the choices, apparently rather successful choices, of principles that we have made. I might remind you that the AA's 12 Steps to Recovery, first appearing in 1939 in the Big Book, are now 30 years old, and they have served us extremely well. The traditions now approach 25 years since their publication in 46. And they, too, have served us well. And while there is great room for interpretation of these principles, and the applications are innumerable, the solid substance of each remains still about as written. So these are reassuring facts about the traditions. People, in looking at the traditions, find very clear statements, and yet, paradoxically, some of them are baffling. Newcomers ask these questions. They say, what do you mean? There are no rules, regulations here? What do you mean? I'm a member if I say so. What do you mean? Nobody can run this thing permanently? What do you mean? There are no penalties or punishments? What do you mean? There's no public controversy. Every society is mixed up with public controversy, and drunks love to controvert. What do you mean, no controversy, et cetera, et cetera? So, the thing that is not so well understood among AAs generally and among our friends is why we selected these particular principles. and how they came into being. And few at this time, now that we are of this age, remember today the tremendous struggles that we had among us in trying to come to these decisions. And because I occupied a place happening to be the number one elder in the thing, and Dr. Bob number two, we were especially in the middle of all of this. Now, Dr. Bob was inherently a much more spiritually qualified person than I. And very naturally, because he was a doctor, he took to this marvelous 12-step job along with Ignatia out there. And he very cheerfully turned over to me the writing and the speaking and the headquarters in New York and that sort of thing. We had a division of labors. So that I especially was subjected to very great personal temptations. In other words, most of these traditions actually run counter to some of my early and sometimes secret aims. And some of this stuff I'd like to share with you because it is relevant to all who follow us oldsters. These temptations will recur time and time and time again. So I think that perhaps I'd like to share some of this sort of thing with you. Against this background, let's have a look at the 12 traditions themselves. Here's the first one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. This is a prudent reminder. Indeed, it is a stern warning that unless AA continues to live, the greater part of us would surely die. And so would the countless alcoholics that we might have helped. This is why the general welfare must come first. Without unity and harmonious action, we shall have nothing at all. I can make no more effective statement about the welfare tradition than the one to be seen in our AA publication, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, as a suitable preamble, setting the pitch and tone of the discussion to follow. Let me share this with you. The unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most cherished quality that our society has. Our lives, the lives of all to come, depend squarely upon us. We stay whole or AA dies. Without unity, the heart of AA would cease to beat. Our world arteries would no longer carry the life-giving grace of God. His gift to us would be spent aimlessly. Back again in their caves, alcoholics would reproach us and say, what a great thing AA might have been. Every AA member knows that he has to conform to the principles of recovery. His life actually depends upon obedience to spiritual principles. If he deviates too far, the penalty is sure and swift. He sickens and finally dies. At first in AA, he goes along because he must. But later on, he discovers a way of life he really wants to live. Moreover, he finds he cannot keep this priceless gift unless he gives it away. Neither he nor anyone else can survive unless the AA message is carried. The moment the 12-step work forms a group, another discovery is made that most individuals cannot even recover unless there is a group. Realization dawns on the individual that he is but a small part of the great whole, that no personal sacrifice is too great for preservation of this fellowship. He learns that the clamor of desires and ambitions within him must be silenced whenever these could damage the group. It becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not. So it has been with AA. By faith and by work, we have been able to build upon the lessons of an incredible experience. These live today in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, God willing, shall sustain us in unity for so long as he may need us. You see, our original functioning had to do with people who started groups. Naturally, Dr. Bob became, you might say, the parent of the Akron group. I became the parent of the New York group. And there was Clarence in Cleveland, and there was Earl in Chicago, and Cliff at Los Angeles. And all of these people became founders of AA in their several localities. And very naturally, there being no other way, they got a few people sobered up after a long and strenuous tussle. These first people became a team. In the structural sense, you might almost call this a local pope and a hierarchy. And this was the top of the AA pyramid to come. The top was built first. And as the pyramid grew in its base and more people came in, the old-timers continued to give spiritual instruction. They either had meetings in their homes or tended to making arrangements. When publicity turned up, they took charge. In other words, they were actually managing the affairs of an infant or adolescent family. And this was just as it should be. But there was a change in this situation. When AA got further spread and rapidly spread, first by the plain dealer articles in Cleveland, and then by Mr. Rockefeller's dinner, and finally the great smash of the Saturday Post piece of 1941, which brought us 6,000 new members within a year's time. Then you had the same phenomena, excepting that local founders, not all of them being models of stability, couldn't last very long. And more and more, there was a disposition in these large masses of AAs to ask, well, these old-timers are all well and good, but are they going to run things forever? And this was a very disconcerting pressure to Dr. Bob and me, and particularly to some of these old-timers. Because we were the first two on the scene, it seems that we had a quality of lasting longer than the others. In fact, I only bowed out just in time here a few years ago, and death took Dr. Bob. But at any rate, this was the fundamental of it. So that you began to develop the group which said, in effect, you old-timers ought to get over on the sidelines. And those of you that we like and respect, we are going to continue to consult. And those of you who are still, let us say, somewhat undeveloped, we shall label bleeding deacons. Well, this injected a new thing. On top of this pyramid of service, now cut off across the top, there appeared something for each group that whizzed round and round and changed personnel every few months lest anybody get too much power, and it was called a rotating committee. And at the group level, this was fine, and it was easy for the groups, knowing everybody at hand, to name successful group committees that acted exactly in a town meeting fashion. Well, then some years later, as urban problems got to be tremendous, and there had to be some head or tail way, when they got into that phase, they found immense difficulty for all of these urban people, or even representatives of them, to get together to choose people, a committee, to manage and conduct an intergroup office. This was a very difficult business. In fact, I can think of one town that where the confusion was so great that you had four or five competing old-timers with telephone numbers, each of which announced that this is AA, not the other one, this one is. Now, when they came to put in an office, the schisms in the town were so bad that they actually had to draw lots to get the first office management out. Well, that wasn't such a great success because it stopped a political clamor, but at the same time, it didn't furnish the office with the best possible top management. But little by little, the intergroup management still remained basically democratic in its structure. The group representatives had all the ultimate power, but the committee managing the office could nominate its successors on the theory that they would know the people of the kind of skills required that would be necessary, and that if the meeting of the group representatives, local ones, didn't agree, they could name their own man still. They held the ultimate power. But this began to make room for something that we now call the trusted servant in the AA tradition too. The discovery that you couldn't operate AA in a large urban area on a purely town meeting basis. It was simply too big. Let alone could you operate AA services worldwide. I mean, you couldn't elect a bunch of trustees to serve here in New York by putting out some names and a slate to vote on all over the world. You can see it wouldn't work. So that after a while, though the ultimate power always continued to remain in the groups, the structure always turned out the same, that servants of the more important services were picked partly by appointment, always subject to check with the group conscience. And in that way, we could get people who were required to do the particular jobs, had the skills, people of excellence for the position. And that's how the structure evolved. Now, parallel to all this, and in fact commencing before it, we had a similar structure for world service down here that finally evolved, although this took many years to complete it. Many AAs will remember that in 1938 we incorporated something called the Alcoholic Foundation. And among other things, the foundation took up over the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which had been published and financed separately, and therefore took the trustees, who were composed of non-alcoholics and a few alcoholics, chosen really by Dr. Bob and me. They took over the title to our literature, and we opened a little office, and when the Saturday Post piece came on with all this great flood of inquiries, we cleared most of them. And then we began to get into problems of public relations and all of the things that the World Office does today. And these were all, without exception, chores that could not be performed in many locations. There had to be some head or tail to literature. There had to be some place and somehow of a lot of other services. There had to be some head and tail to public relations. Policies had to be devised and all this sort of thing. Well, for many years, I suppose partly because Bob and I had set it up that way back in 38, before there were any intergroup, this thing refused, at this end, here in New York refused to evolve. Partly because it was felt that since the groups were having such a hard time to even have a clubhouse without a furor or to manage their simple affairs, how could we possibly bring traditions to bear on this situation down here? The operation had been very successful. Our friends in a majority on the board, non-alcoholics, as a protection to the vagaries of people like Dr. Bob and me and other alcoholic trustees, well, this was all in the pot. So what would we do? It took from 1945, just after the tradition came out, to 1951 to persuade everybody concerned that as an experiment, a conference of delegates should be called, at least from the United States and Canada, properly weighted according to population in each locality, to come down here and to take a look at these services, which we who had been running them all these years felt had been invaluable to AA and might have been accountable for one half of our growth and a great deal of unity. So this is how the group conscience came into being. And this is what we mean by AA's trusted servants. Special people selected for their special abilities, but never people who shall govern. Now we come to tradition three, dealing with this very important matter of membership. We alcoholics have been an ostracized people. Sometimes we have been actual prisoners of society. At all times, we have been prisoners of ourselves, you might say. So when AA proffers its hand to the alcoholic, what does the alcoholic want? He wants freedom. He wants to belong. So therefore, we have tried to reduce every possible resistance that he might have. He is generally sore at religion. He is sore at medicine. He is sore at society. Perhaps at a distance he has heard that AA is another religious organization and complains that the missions did him in and made him worse. So when he arrives and finds that it is a fact that AA's only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, his relief is immense. When he is told that there is a spiritual quality about AA, but this requires no theology or religious belief in the ordinary sense, that the group can be his higher power, then his release and his freedom knows no bounds, and he plunges in to the new stream that comes out into a happier and sober life. So therefore, we should keep this door wide open. We cannot put any strictures. And we bind ourselves not to, upon it. We cannot compel the new man to believe anything, to pay anything, to do anything. We actually invite him to disagree with everything we say. And still, if he wishes to stay around, he's an AA if he says so. This is the charter of individual freedom that is portrayed in this most important tradition three, dealing with membership. Just as tradition three is a charter for individual freedom, so is tradition four a charter, really, for group freedom. It poses the question, when is an AA group? Does it have any limitations upon its liberty? And we say no. Each AA group, like the individual, has a right to be wrong. The only thing that we ask, but do not demand, of a group trying for sobriety, who wish to call themselves AA, is that they do not publicly mingle the AA name with some other enterprise. Quite obviously, nobody would be very interested, and it would be a great brewer of trouble were we to talk about Protestant groups and Catholic groups and Republican groups and communist AA groups. This would be absurd and troublemaking on the face of it. So long as their primary purpose is directed towards sobriety and they don't get us married to anyone else, this is our only requirement. Otherwise, they can have it just the way they want it. And the group itself, you must remember from tradition too, is the ultimate seat of authority for the whole movement. So that even in a town meeting democracy, the strictures upon such bodies are much greater than they are upon an AA group. It is a vast expanse and charter of liberty indeed, and we know that we are safe in granting, because too much departure from our traditional principles or from the 12 steps brings its own pressures and punishments. Leave it to John Barleycorn to take care of the foolish dissenter. Meanwhile, let's chart our groups for liberty as well as the individuals. This is autonomy. Now that we've considered group autonomy or self-direction, and we have said that every group has a right to be wrong, strangely enough, tradition 5 centers on the single purpose of the ideal AA group. And the single purpose tradition has had a long history of conflict. You'll remember that back in 1938, when our trusteeship was set up, the original incorporation empowered AA and its trustees to participate in any and all aspects of the alcohol field, excepting, I believe, to lobby for prohibition. At that time, it was supposed that we should have our own chain of hospitals and that we should have halfway houses financed by AA as such, and we needed rest farms, and we needed to get into education because, after all, who knew better about these matters than us drunks? But long, long experience has told us that for practical reasons, reasons of safety, reasons of protection against compromising our energy, and for reasons of self-protection, and for reasons of love, for all of these reasons, each AA group ought to confine itself to its single purpose. To read the tradition, each group has but one primary purpose: to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Immediately, people will say, but why shouldn't we be in these other enterprises? The fact is that each of us needs AA work for his own survival. We need to avoid complications and distractions. So we continue to point at the single purpose: to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, another reason for the single purpose is our unique value to the alcoholic who still suffers. This cannot yet be duplicated by any other group or any approach. And thus far, it has brought sobriety in 15,000 groups to maybe 500,000 AA members. Our assignment is still enormous, just on this single purpose line. with our present membership if only we could get alcoholics to approach us. If only professional people having alcoholics in charge would allow us to assist. Instead of sobering up 20,000 drunks a year with the 12-step work that we do, we could just as well be sobering up 100,000 alcoholics per year. And God knows this is an assignment big enough. And we are uniquely fitted to do this by ourselves, or still better, by cooperation with other agencies. So I think that now there is no doubt that every AA group will choose to stick to its primary purpose. AA members participate in other activities as members, as citizens. This is fine too. But as groups, as a fellowship, national and international, let us cleave to our single purpose. Let that old-fashioned adage, shoemaker, stick to thy last, be our primary direction in this matter hereafter.